Good afternoon, everybody. This is Barb Pello, Group Director at InfoTrends, and I'm delighted that you could join us for our webinar this afternoon. It's called Back to School, The Future of Educational Book Publishing. And today I'm delighted to be joined by what I consider to be three experts that know this market probably better than anybody else. And first is Neil Goff, and he's the president of Ergmont Associates. Steve Franzino is the vice president of technology at Courier Corporation. And Mike Kling, who's the president and CEO of Webcom. Relative to today's session, what I would like to do before we get started is give you a couple of tips to ensure that you can enjoy the webinar. First of all, if you're having any technical difficulties, let us know by using the Q&A box, or you can troubleshoot by clicking the help widget below. We'll be taking questions throughout the course of the webinar today. So as the speakers are talking, please key in your questions so we can ask the speaker those questions live as opposed to waiting until the end of the session. Make sure you disable pop-up blockers. And if you want to see what the console can do, you can click on the Tips for Attendees widget for a complete rundown. Now for our agenda. I'm going to spend just a couple minutes up front talking about what we see as some critical trends in the book market. And then what you'll get is a good industry perspective from Neil. And then Steve Franzino and Mike Kling will talk to you about how technology can make educational publishing much more efficient. First of all, when we take a look at the market, I think we're all dealing with an interesting set of dynamics. Everywhere you go, you see people with their iPads. You don't know what quantity of books to produce. And so we're dealing with uncertainty, and uncertainty says that you as publishers don't want to take excessive risk, especially when it comes to inventory. Now, for the book market in general, there's good news. For those of you that are familiar with some of the reporting that's done on a regular basis, Bookstats and the American Association of Publishers and the Book Industry Study Group released data last August that talked about what was going on in the book market. And basically, book publishers' revenues increased 5.6% between 2008 and 2010. Unit sales in all formats were $2.57 billion. That was a 4.1% increase. And we saw resurgence across all markets. The best increases were obviously in higher ed and at $4.55 billion, and that was up 18.7%. Now, what we're seeing is, given the market conditions, there's a whole new world out there in terms of book publishing. And what we're seeing are print technologies that are going to mitigate the risk associated with book publishing. You'll hear later today about new high-speed inkjet technologies, as well as there are electrophotographic technologies that mean that you can produce books in a run length of one cost-effectively. And what you're going to see is service providers that will support moving books seamlessly between print and digital editions. InfoTrends does a lot of work relative to understanding what's going on in the marketplace in terms of how pages are moving to digital. And what we do is we track actually the migration of traditionally printed books into digital, or traditionally printed pages into digital pages. And what we're seeing is that one of the biggest areas of increase is, in fact, the concept that books will move into an on-demand type environment. Books are actually going to dominate the analog to digital migration driven by high-speed inkjet. And, in fact, our projections are that there will be an increase of 45 billion pages between now and 2015 in terms of books moving from that traditional print environment to digital. That's a 14.2% compound annual growth rate. And projections are that almost 17% of books will be done on demand by the time we hit 2015. Now, I think you've all heard this before, and you'll hear it again today, but the benefits of books on demand mean that you as publishers reduce your risk, you increase or improve your cycle time and time to market, you can do specialty printing and generate fresh content very affordably, and ultimately it yields for you as publishers bottom line profitability. You've also heard that there's going to be exponential growth in ebook adoption. And quite honestly, that says that the changes in book publishing are likely to be exponential and not linear. And so what we're going to do for the balance of today is spend time talking about what the future holds for educational publishers. And with that, what I'm going to do is turn it over, and I'll let Neil introduce himself to Neil Goff from Ergmont Associates. Neil, take it away.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here. As Barb said, my name is Neil Goff. I'm president of Ergmont Associates. It's a consulting firm that gives advice and counsel to educational publishers and technology companies. And before I started Ergmont Associates, I was a publisher for 20 years and have a lot of experience in the industry. Most recently, I was president of Weekly Reader. I'm having a little trouble syncing my slides to what is showing in the box. Is everybody okay? Got it. So what I want to talk about is the macro trends that are affecting the industry. I'm having trouble with the slides again. It's not
here. I'll get you set up here, Neil. No problem.
Okay. Because obviously, what happens in publishing is a reflection or a function of what's happening in the market in general. And most of this is what I'll talk about is relevant to the K-12 market, which is where I have most of my expertise. So I'm going to talk about five major trends driving changes in the market: the advancements in technology, competition from free content, which is sometimes known as open educational resources, transition to the Common Core standards, which I'll explain to those of you who don't know what they are, funding issues that are related to the economy and the political environment, and the policy agendas of the government, and also of large private foundations who are actually driving a lot of the educational policy agenda these days as well. And then I'll talk a little bit about the forces that are holding back some of the changes. So is everybody seeing?
Neil, I'll take care of advancing your slide for you. Just tell me when you're ready to go to the next slide.
We should be seeing a slide that says technological change.
You got it.
This could be a subject of an entire webinar by itself, so in a way I just have to hit the highlights here. But there's lots going on in schools having to do with technology, and, of course, it's a reflection of what's happening in the consumer market. The big changes that are worth talking about are the penetration of interactive whiteboards, sometimes known as smart boards, but actually smart is a brand name, so the proper generic term is interactive whiteboards. They are now in about 40% of classrooms, and for those of you who don't know what they are, they're similar to what you'd see on election night that John King from CNN stands in front of. You tap them, and they respond. The growth of the hardware has sort of been out ahead of the growth of content and software for those boards, but more and more as penetration has been strong, publishers and others are developing content for use with whiteboards. There's a as those of you who are in the industry know, and this is almost a too obvious statement to make, a huge trend switchover from print to digital content. Lots of publishers and lots of others creating content to be used on whiteboards and in digital devices. It's a little bit of a wild west out there these days. There's no one standard for deployment of digital content, although much of it is available on the web, which makes that problem a little less of a problem. But there's a lot of discussion, as you probably know, of digital textbooks, and there's not yet one dominant standard for digital textbooks. So it's going to be a while before that all settles down and everybody is using the same kind of hardware, same kind of software to make content available on digital devices. The focus of digital devices in the classroom has shifted from laptops to tablets and smartphones. Lots of schools are doing pilot programs with iPads, and others are doing them with Kindles and Nooks, although at this point I think the device of choice is the iPad. That's a device of choice for use with students, I should say. And there's a big growth in use of online courses and distance learning. A lot of kids these days might take one or two courses online rather than a traditional classroom setting, and that's something that's going to grow.
Neil, I do have one quick question from our audience. And Neil, I'll take care of advancing the slides here for you. The question that I've got is give us a perspective, if you would, on how rapidly you see the adoption of iPads in the classroom.
That's a really interesting question. right now you're seeing a lot of schools, and when I say a lot, I wouldn't want you to think it's a majority, but let's say getting up into 5 or 10% of schools buying a bunch of iPads and doing pilots with them. Interestingly, the hardware is ahead of the software. Schools get iPads, and the first problem they're confronted with is what do we use on these iPads? And because Apple controls its ecosystem and you can only get stuff through the Apple Store, it's actually not that easy to then deploy different content across hundreds of devices. I think that's going to change very quickly. In fact, I have a client that's got software that solves the problem. So I think what we're going to see is a year or two of lots of experimentation and then probably pretty quick take-up. Now, there's a related thing that I cover later called the BYOD or bring your own device movement. Schools, you know, traditionally have fought the idea that kids should bring their technology to school with them and basically, you know, make them park their cell phones at the door. That's changing. Schools are realizing that they can save a lot of money and sort of not fight what kids want to do by letting them use their devices. So I think in probably 4 or 5 year time frame, you'll see lots and lots of schools allowing students to use their own devices, and I think many of those devices will be iPads.
Okay. Thanks, Neil.
The next trend I'd like to talk about is open educational resources, or if I use a less elegant term, it's called free stuff. There are publishers who provide, who create content that obviously they want people to pay for are now finding themselves competing with providers of free content, and they can be individual teachers or they can be more organized organizations, some of which are funded by government, some of which are funded by private foundations. There's a lot of development of materials that are available to teachers, usually at the granular level. You don't see that many well-presented programs of OER, Open Educational Resources. But it's becoming a factor, and I think publishers are getting to the point where they realize it's not going away, and many of them are sort of in the if you can't beat them, join them kind of mode and trying to figure out how to, if they can't fight it, how to integrate OER into what they do or how to provide value by curating and organizing open educational resources. The best known case of this is Pearson Foundation, which is obviously connected to Pearson Education, with funding from the Gates Foundation, is creating a curriculum of free resources, and then Pearson, there'll be a paid component, so there'll be a free version that's available of OER, and then a sort of enhanced, souped-up version of more materials and more in-depth materials provided by Pearson that people have to pay for. Next, if you can advance another slide, please.
We're all set, Neil.
Okay, I'm not seeing it, so I have to sort of figure out where you are.
It's Common Core standards.
Okay, thank you. The next big force, and this is the one of the group that's sort of not driven by kind of political economic changes, is less so, I guess I should say, is the move to Common Core standards. The background of this is that up to now, every state in the country has had its own curriculum standards, and while they're often very similar, they are different and put publishers in the position of having to customize what they do across states. There's been a movement for the last couple of years to get everybody on the same page, so to speak, and the movement was not driven by the federal government. It was rather driven by a group of people who recognized that the only way to get states to volunteer to be part of a so-called Common Core would be to make participation voluntary. It was very skillfully done, so we now have 46 states, if you include District of Columbia, adopting the Common Core, and the Common Core standards are new curriculum standards in English and language arts. I mean, in language arts and math, and they're sort of designed to get students to be ready for careers in college by the time they graduate. The timetable for implementation of the Common Core is the 2014-15 school year. And the federal government has funded two consortia to develop the assessments that will test students on the Common Core standards. it's kind of a funny approach in a way, because the standards were adopted first, and now the assessments are being developed, and publishers are in the position of having to try to develop curriculum to meet standards for assessments that have not yet been developed. So there's a little bit of confusion in the marketplace and a little lack of clarity as to how profoundly this will change what's going to go on in schools, but it's gaining momentum as the deadline nears, and it looks like a pretty big opportunity for publishers, because schools are going to need new curriculum materials in order to meet the new standards. Next slide, please. The next thing we're talking about is the funding environment itself, which has been difficult ever since the recession, the 2008-2009 recession. And, you know, most of educational funding, despite all the conversation about federal funding, actually comes at the state and local level. And, of course, local funding is largely driven by property taxes. School funding tends to lag the economy. It falls off a year or two or even three after a recession begins, and then it lags on the recovery. So while there's lots of signs of an economic recovery, and however anemic the recovery is, the fact is that state revenues are beginning to recover, and many states now have higher tax revenues than they had last year. School funding has not yet recovered, and we're, as I think everybody knows, in a political environment where there's a lot of anti-tax sentiment that's putting a lid on the recovery, so that even if we have the kind of economic recovery that everybody would like to see us have, it may be that school funding never quite goes back to where it was. And, of course, in an election year in particular, we don't know what's going to happen next year and what the winds in Washington will do on the federal side, which is perhaps 8 or 9% of the total funding comes from federal government, but on the margin it makes a big difference. And related to this is something I talked about before, the OER, because of the constrained funding environment, a lot of the states are in a mode where they're saying, well, we don't need to fund textbooks as much as we did, because people can use the free materials, and that's sort of part of what's constraining the recovery and spending on school materials as the economy comes back. And that probably transitions easily to the discussion of government policy and the policy agendas of the large foundations that have taken a stronger and stronger role in funding school reforms and foundations like the Gates Foundation, or the Hewlett Foundation is another one that's very involved in school reform. Since the Democrats took over the federal government, interestingly, the federal agenda really hasn't changed very much. The changes that were put in place when the Bush administration put in No Child Left Behind, that philosophy is pretty much still in place, a philosophy where everything needs to be measured, and kids or teachers are increasingly held accountable for school performance. I think the difference between the Obama administration and Bush administration more has to do with the philosophy of implementation rather than the underlying philosophy. And the Obama administration has proven itself very willing to use funding and both the incentive of getting funds or the punishment of losing funds to drive school reform, and much of that is involved in causing schools, A, to adopt the Common Core. They've sort of put their muscle behind encouraging schools to adopt the Common Core, and to put in systems to evaluate teachers and have part of those evaluations be based on how students perform. The Gates Foundation and other foundations like it are putting their weight behind some of these initiatives, and as I said before, also putting their weight behind development of OER, which does create a bit of a competitive conundrum for publishers.
Neil, before we go on, somebody asked, and I think we may have had a couple people that got on a little late. Could you again define what OER is for the audience?
It stands for Open Educational Resources, and as I said before, the sort of colloquial term for it is free stuff. It's materials that are developed with the intention of allowing educators or kids to use them without paying for them. A lot of them are governed by a copyright law that's known as the Creative Commons copyright, which is a copyright that rather than saying if I own these materials, you have to pay me for them, says no, you're allowed to use them, but sort of governs, has some rules, ground rules written about the reuse of the materials. You can or can't revise them. You can't charge for them, that sort of thing. But essentially, the rules are written to encourage sharing and encourage free use, as opposed to restrict it by only allowing people who pay for the materials to use them.
Great. And one last quick question, and then I'll let you finish up here. But the other quick question we had is open sourcing affecting higher ed more than K through 12?
I would say it's about the same. There's a different dynamic in higher ed, because in higher ed, of course, you get professors adopt materials and then more or less tell students that's what you need to have in order to take my course. And there is certainly an OER movement in higher ed as much as there is, or as well as there is in K-12, and I frankly don't have sort of numbers on my fingertips to say what the difference is, but it's happening in both places, and it's happening in a significant way.
Great. Thanks, Neil.
Just a couple more slides. Having talked about the some of the forces that are driving change, I also wanted to mention some of the things that are holding it back. One is what I call teachers' reform fatigue, that teachers who've been in the business for a long time are sort of used to the phenomenon of this year's fad of reform, and they tend to have reforms introduced every time there's a change in administration above them, and they've developed, or some of them at least, have developed a certain skepticism, or you could say even cynicism, over reforms, and don't necessarily embrace each new change that comes in because they figure there's another one coming next year. I mentioned before about lack of standardization of formats. As long as there's a sort of Apple versus PC versus other content standards war going on, and there's no sort of treaty organization that makes everybody agree that we're going to use that everybody will use the same format across devices in school, it'll be a little bit chaotic. And the bring your own device movement actually sort of reinforces the lack of standardizations over formats. I think it will sort itself out, but it's going to take a few years. And then there is some backlash against everything going digital. There's a lot of people who, you know, can take a strong point of view that if you're trying to teach a kid how to read, the best device for doing that is with a book. And particularly in the lower grades, I think there's a strong desire to make sure that children still interact with books before they get introduced to digital devices, or those devices are introduced to them, at least in the classroom. And as I mentioned before, there is a bit of a trend of schools buying hardware before they quite know what they're going to fill up that hardware with. And I think there'll be some disappointments when some of these pilot programs, they buy the hardware and find, ironically, a dearth of content to go with that hardware. And finally, because the hardware environment, or the funding environment, I meant to say, is not terribly strong, that does tend to slow down the pace of innovation. So just to wrap up, I'd say that at this point the pace of change is incremental, but there's so many forces at play that we could see a sort of tipping point and acceleration of change. I think there'll always be a role for paper, as I mentioned before, particularly in the lower grades. And I think that while there's a lot of digital content in schools, we're not going to see the adoption of e-tech books in a big, big way for a while the confusion over devices and software standards is sorted out, and while the textbook publishers, frankly, have an incentive to keep people buying their books as long as they can.
Well, great. Neil, I want to thank you. And what I'm going to do now, and there are a number of questions that we didn't get to all of while you were speaking, we'll come back at the end and hopefully address several of them. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to turn it over to Steve Franzino, and he's going to share with you how Courier is working with publishers on dealing with a lot of these issues. Take it away, Steve.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. First off, I'd like to say that I agree with one of the bullet points on Neil's presentation. Use real books. All right, let's go to the agenda. Okay, these are the bullet points I'm going to talk about. We'll do a little quick Courier introduction, a little Courier commercial. And I'm going to talk about the life cycle of a title and how it fits into, well, more how inkjet fits into a mix with offset. And we'll discuss that and then some trends and opportunities that we see and some conclusion slides. Okay. Courier has been around for a long time, and we've reinvented ourselves quite a few times along the way. We're headquartered here in Massachusetts, and actually that is a 2011 revenue number. It's a typo there. I apologize. And we're traded on the NASDAQ stock exchange. These are the markets that we serve. It's sort of a third, a third, a third to some degree, religious, trade, and education. In the education market, it's probably about two-thirds higher ed and one-third LHI, and 1% is sort of other. We have four offset plants, the Kendallville, Indiana, being the largest four-color offset plant, mostly educational textbooks get produced there. We have four large high-capacity manroll and presses in there and some other webs. Our Westford, Massachusetts plant is a one- and two-color education and trade operation, and in Philadelphia we have a lightweight paper operation. And also in Indiana, in Terre Haute, is a component operation, sort of a sister operation to the Kendallville plant. And then we started up a digital operation here in North Chelmsford. We got started here in the spring of 2010 and installed our first HP inkjet web press. At that time, it was the third HP press built by HP. And so we have a lot of experience with the technology. And we also have some toner equipment that was part of an acquisition of Highcrest Media that also happened around that time frame about 2 years ago. So we started this operation, Courier Digital Solutions. And, the point I wanted to make here is that, we didn't start out building this thing as a print-on-demand operation. We really were trying to, set up an ultra-short-run book manufacturing operation that that would produce a book that would be equivalent to offset in every way, the way it prints, the way it's the paper that's used, the binding style. And I'll say this, though, it's moving rapidly towards lower run lengths and one-offs, but our focus is to really extend the range of printing that we offer and maintain the same high-quality standard that you get on the offset platform. Okay, so that's a picture of what an HP inkjet web press looks like with a Mueller Martini folder on it on the left-hand side. We have three of these HP T350 inkjet webs. It's the heart of the operation. It's actually the only installation in the world that has three of these identical presses side by side under one roof. So it's a lot of press capacity. That's a picture of me standing next to the press to give you a little bit of scale. I'm 6'3". So it's a big machine. It's not something that's on wheels. So this is a very sort of familiar slide graph that people you've seen that shows title life. And, as you start off and as you have new titles and then you peak and then you have what they call the long tail going off to the right. And I have two shaded areas, one offset on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side is really what's rapidly turning into an automatic replenishment program that kind of fits in on that side. And, we're a big offset printer as well, and we really see offset helping a publisher manage the risk in title life. And, really a lot of the waste that happens in the educational textbook market is either on the front end where a product didn't really sell very well or didn't manage the inventory aggressively as it comes off of peak. And it's a difficult thing to do. There's often a lot of books that are out there. You have to take returns. There's lots of work in the channel, a lot of product in the channel. You get returns, you're in an out-of-stock situation. It's hard to manage. And so what Inkjet has done is it really sort of manages that risk on those two fringes, those two sides of that blue bar which says offset. And that helps, you know, what we say in the front end. Well, let's go down to the bullet that says pre-release. That has always been sort of a digital product. You know, this is something where you were either you were in the school, you were doing adoption copies, or you were doing some pre-sales type of material. You know, in the past, people did that on toner. It didn't matter if you were on different paper. It didn't matter if it bulked differently. You didn't necessarily have to produce a product that totally represented exactly what you were going to produce in offset. But now you have the opportunity to do that with Inkjet. And so I think there's an advantage there. On the new title side, that's lowering your risk. That's lowering your bet on the first run. We see publishers taking advantage of that and, you know, lowering their run quantities and turning their inventories more frequently. At the peak, offset is a pretty cost-effective platform. If you're printing, you know, 5, 10, 20,000 books, you know, that's the platform to be on. And then on the other side of it, again, turning that inventory more often, but start to do that more often, and then flip this thing into an automatic replenishment program as quickly as you can. Once you sort of have the content sort of locked down, it really becomes a SKU number in the warehouse. You know, you just can just turn those inventories as quickly as you want. The back to life piece of it, you know, that is really something that may be more trade related. You know, it's where you would, you know, never put anything out of print, right? If you can sell one copy, you sell one copy, and then eventually it goes to a POD platform towards the very end. Though I'd like to say that it probably could wait on that, because when you're producing a product with the inkjet technology, you're actually producing a product that really looks like the offset product. And when you go to POD, sort of, you know, you know it's two paper options and, you know, sort of limited cover type of finishing. That makes sense? Let's see. And then what's happening as the technology gets faster and faster and wider, and, you know, it's going to eat at the fringes of offset on both sides. You know, so that band will get narrower. You know, the inkjet will eat more from either one of those sides as we see it. Okay. So one of the big hurdles in this thing when we first got started was, you know, the quality that was coming off of the device and whether it would meet the needs of educational marketplace. And for the most part, it has. And, you know, it's a product that closely matches offset. In many cases, it either uses the exact same paper or equivalent grade of paper that has all the same characteristics as the offset sister sheet has. It bulks the same as a result. In our case, we come off our press as folded signatures and run it through the same sort of binding equipment that you would in an offset plant. And so the result is a product that comes off that really can live and mix and match in inventory in the warehouse. You know, so, you know, the product, you wouldn't have to have that set up as a separate SKU because the product is different. So as a result, because of Inkjet really being in the marketplace and has taken a bigger role in it, you know, educational publishers are now focused more and more out of, you know, wringing out any remaining waste in the process, and you know, they're very, very focused on obsolescence and inventory reduction. You know, they want to free up the, you know, they want to free up the working capital for product development and not just tie it to you know, materials and labor and inventory. You know, as a result, it's running run lengths down, and that's across the board. You know, offset and digital, and we're seeing a much higher order frequency, much more drop shipments. You know, really, you know, now getting to the point of, you know, bypassing the warehouse entirely, and on the digital side of things, it's really fulfilling orders. You know, because the turn time, the cycle time is so fast. you know, orders can come in, we can fulfill those orders, especially in the custom educational market where it's going to a specific class or to a specific university. You know, there's no need to bring that into a warehouse to then redirect it out to its end customer.
Steve, I do have a quick question for you.
Sure.
When you talk about the title life cycle, do you see editions of books shifting from offset to digital, and then in some instances actually going back to traditional offset?
Yes, I do, actually. And that's the beauty of having this sort of, you know, product that's equivalent in both inkjet and offset. You could have, let's say there's a world event that happens and you happen to have a textbook that is, you know, specifically about that world event, that could spark a new life to a title that might go back to an offset run. So absolutely.
And then when you take a look at the paper sizes, what kind of paper sizes are we dealing with here?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, it's changed now that we have these inkjet presses. You know, we don't typically talk about cutoff anymore. You know, we don't specifically talk about presses like, well, that's an 11-inch four-color press and that's a, you know, one-color 9-inch press. Or it's a variable cutoff. We typically talk about web widths, right? And so
yeah.
It's how wide and how many out you can yield on the sheet. So in our case, we have 30-inch webs. We run various types of imposition software on that to yield, you know, different product sizes on it. I don't think there's – is the question, is there any limitation in sizes?
No, it was just what paper size. So if I wind up – what is my finished book maximum size?
Well, you know, we can produce a 10x12 product on that press. I mean,
okay.
In the education market, I don't know if there's a requirement that's much bigger.
Okay.
You know, I can do oblongs, and you can do pretty much anything.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. So, you know, to the point of the press, it's a variable data printing device. So, you know, publishers are increasingly taking advantage of that and, you know, customization. And they're pushing customization in as much product as they can, and you know this is a good thing for the printed book. You know, it's a if you're going to compete against a digital online product, you know, it has to be timely and it has to be customized, and this is the platform to kind of do that on, and then it also cleans up a lot of the other messy stuff that's still part of the publishing and printing workflow, especially around. This hybrid rebind workflow where you've overprinted SIGs and you're storing SIGs in the warehouse and then you're printing digital for the customized content and then you're putting these things back together and binding up the books. You know, people are saying, forget it. We'll just, you know, this stuff should be spinning on a hard drive on a server and then, you know, we'll paginate it together with software and then just print the whole book. And so people are moving in that direction as well. Okay. 2 more minutes. I'm going to move on this thing a little bit. Okay. So, you know, big impact on the warehouse for the publishers, right? Those things, those warehouses were built for bulk locations. They like to store pallet loads and truckloads of stuff. And, now it's shorter run lanes, frequent replenishments. There's more stress on the loading, the receiving dock and the shipping docks at the warehouse. And the warehouses are increasingly becoming honeycombed because, you know, they don't have, they're not filling the locations the way the locations were designed. So lots of stress on the warehouse. And then the other, caution is, there's sort of a glass ceiling here. So if you're not focused on the ins and outs of your business, at least for us and for the publishers that we deal with, you know, if you're not dealing with electronic transactions coming over the transom, and we're already talking about increasing the number of orders, by a lot, and you're not dealing with automatic replenishment programs, and you're not doing sort of direct ships, you're going to get hurt because the demands on that are large. And so a couple quick conclusion slides here. You know, for the most part, inkjet has met that requirement in education. It's got good color gamut, good wet and dry rub durability. The highlighter thing has been resolved, and the coated paper options are more and more. So that's going all in the right direction. And then this too, inkjet has really brought the true capacity to the marketplace. One of these T350 ink, and this is, I'm giving you best case scenarios on these pieces of equipment. One T350 inkjet press, can do what a 15, I put iGens here, but that very well could be, a sheet fed indigo press or anything else, things that run at 120, 130 pages per minute. So its sheer capacity is huge. And, which allows the publishers to take advantage of that stuff. And let's see, and then this is the big thing, and this is really where we try to focus our customers on the most is, it's that unit cost mentality that's forced all of that extra waste in the process. And, it's really obscured the big potential here, which is, freeing up working capital, moving it towards product development and reducing obsolescence and reducing warehouse and shipping costs. So, did I put you back on schedule here? Pretty close.
There you go.
All right.
Thanks a bunch, Stephen. We do have questions, and we will get it to as many as we can.
Yeah.
If we can't get to them, we'll work them in and respond to you individually. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to Mike Kling, and he's the president and CEO of Webcom, to share his perspective on how they can help the educational publisher. Mike, take it away.
Well, thanks, Barb, and thanks for including Webcom on today's webinar with all your listeners. I think it's clear from your research that the digital transition for books, especially, as you mentioned earlier, four-color books, is well underway. And I couldn't agree more with a lot of Steve's comments in his presentation and the strategies to lever inkjet benefits for educational publishers and new opportunities within title life management. So I think all the discussion today is really positive for book publishers, especially educational publishers. At Webcom, we see it as our role to bring some of the latest book production technology forward to support really customized publishing programs for our publishers. And I think the customization acknowledges that many of the publishers on today's webinar have vastly different needs from large global publishers to many smaller publishers. So in the next 15 minutes, what I'd like to do is give everyone some insight on how new technology can support educational publishers to deal with a number of the issues that Neil and Barb have already outlined, and present two case studies of the benefits that accrued to two of Webcom's book publishing customers over the last year on how they've used the technology and our programs to help them deal with the dynamics and the changes in their business. In the end, I hope that we can show you how you can get into the digital dance and eventually start dancing to your own tune and define your own success. For those, there's many people that probably are part of Webcom's current educational publishing customer base, and some of you that have known and worked with us over the 35 years we've been in business. But for those who maybe Webcom's name isn't as familiar, we're a book manufacturing leader in North America for both digital inkjet book production as well as web offset production. Our company has been producing books for the last three decades, and over the last few years produced around 25 million books per year for educational publishers, for trade publishers, professional reference, and religious publishers. We produce all our books from our plant in Toronto and serve publishers throughout North America. The plant is within a one-day's drive of about 70% of the U.S. population and over 80% of the Canadian population, which makes it a great hub for the distribute and print models that are developing with inkjet and other digital technologies. We're proud to be involved in a number of North American industry associations, such as the Book Manufacturers Institute, which I'm honored to be the current president of, including the Book Periodical Council and participation with Printing Industries of America, Canopy, and the Green Press Initiative. All the books manufactured at our Webcom are targeted for publishers, book publishers, and we're working hard to get on the same page with our publishers to help deal with all the changes and the challenges that have been outlined in the webinar so far today. I won't go into great depth in this because I think Neil did a great job at the start referring to the challenges that AEP members, LHI publishers are dealing with, the technology changes that he mentioned. Whether they be incremental today with the risk of being exponential tomorrow are real things that keep a lot of us up at night worrying, are we in the right spot with the right products in the right place? OER and the free stuff he mentioned, real cause for concern for all of us, and certainly many of our publishers transition to Common Core standards. Lots of opportunity for change and challenges there, along with the funding uncertainty and the policy changes that Neil mentioned, I think really put into perspective some of the dynamic change that our publishers, especially educational publishers, are dealing with. And the conclusions that I think come from that are that educational publishers need to keep flexibility in their publishing programs, whether that be their print programs, but also their electronic and digital programs. Educational publishers need to be open and consider new options, processes, and book models to keep them nimble, to deal with an uncertain future and the rapid pace of change that is upon us all right now. Webcom's role and position, if educational publishers need to be flexible, they need to be responsive to changes and to drive out costs and stay nimble, then it's clear that our challenge as a book manufacturer is to bring breakthrough technology and book production programs to bear for our book for our publishers, and invest and develop programs that support educational publishers and their end users and book readers. So the paradigm shift that I think Steve did a great job outlining for digital, the stigma that digital was less than offset, or that publishers had to compromise their print products if they went from offset to digital, is a paradigm shift that technology and I think leading edge printers have been able to help publishers move along the curve with. Offset equivalent quality and print reproduction, especially in four color, has gone leaps and bounds built on the HP inkjet solutions over the last few years. The ability to produce full color throughout books, or just produce color on selected pages without having to pay for color costs throughout a book, as the traditional offset models have really opened up new paradigms for publishers. The paper options that Steve outlined, a wide range and a continually developing range of papers that include the popular 45-pound coated grades, but more recently have expanded into 60, 80-pound coated and gloss matte stocks and a full range of low-cost groundwoods and offset uncoated papers allow publishers to move product through its life cycle without having to compromise or make a noticeable difference for digital inkjet books. Run sizes in the areas of tens of books or hundreds of books or right up to 2,000-3,000 copies, we believe, are cost competitive for publishers to use digital inkjet production. And book bindings that don't look like the taped book bindings of digital production of 10 years ago, that they're comparable and just as durable and resistant to high use in educational environments as offset traditional books are key parts of the paradigm shift and what's available in the new print production realities of 2012. So Webcom's answer to these challenges and our offer for all educational publishers throughout North America has been branded under our Book Forward technology branding. And the Book Forward program is underpinned with an investment in two high-speed, wide-width, full-color HP digital inkjet presses. And like Courier, Webcom started our investment into inkjet in 2010. And as dedicated book manufacturers, I think both our companies have been leading edge and committed to bringing the robust, full-color, complete book manufacturing solutions to bear for educational and trade and reference publishers over the last couple of years. We really took the inkjet technology that had been popular in transactional and statement printing and developed it along with our technology partners to make it a reality for book publishers and bring a number of benefits that had been available in those markets to bear for book publishers. As Barb said, that's the positive rosy outlook for digital inkjet printing with book publishing over the next couple of years.
Hey, Mike, I got a quick question for you before you move on. you know, one of the things that our audience members asked was they said, you know, print on demand is more expensive than traditional book printing. Given the inkjet investments you've made, has the print on demand cost come down significantly for the educational publisher, and by how much?
And I think print on demand and those economics are really highlighted in the two case studies that we've got at the
great. We'll hold on that then.
Stay on the edge of your seat, Barb, because it's pretty
you
breakthrough.
Got it.
And, yeah, there we go. Our Book Forward programs are really aligned to deal with some of the challenges that Neil outlined, and we've got three specific programs that we've developed for publishers to address the customized needs that an educational publisher, trade, or reference publisher might deal with. All the Book Forward programs are set up on a three-pronged strategy. The technology is definitely a prerequisite. HP and our other technology partners have helped us bring that technology to bear, but along with technology, you don't bring the full solution to the market for a publisher. So technology is a key component, but along with technology, you need to have investments in process, which would include automation, integration, and lowering the cost of managing orders for publishers as you get smaller. And many more frequent orders, we need to have processes and changes in both our publishing and production environments to make that a reality. And investments in people. It's different people than the ink craftsmen of the past or the press operators of the past. We need people that think with an MIS mindset and can bring automation and streamlined processes between our customers and our production operations to bear for these Book Forward programs. So our Step Forward program is aligned to Title Life Management, which takes offset and inkjet digital printing, allows a publisher to seamlessly straddle the quantities and manage that life of title, as Steve outlined, in a very cost-efficient way. Our Fast Forward Book Forward program is a program which allows cycle times to be reduced to 2 to 5 days and allow you to be responsive and address some unforeseen changes in demand for product. And our Straightforward Book Forward program is a flat per-page pricing that's customized to a publisher's unique volume and profile of their publishing program. It allows them to get the same cost per unit for 10 books, 100 books, or 1,000 books, dependent on that profile of that program. So bringing those types of programs to bear really addresses the challenges we believe that educational publishers are dealing with, the need for shorter runs, the ability to put a classroom size order in, whether that be 22 books, 78 books, or 33 books, without the necessity of going to strictly a book of one or a POD model, which still has a higher cost than runs of tens or hundreds. More frequent orders, as I just mentioned, the ability to remove risk and uncertainty from building inventories, revenue optimization, simpler process, et cetera. And for Webcom, those investments over the last 2 years have exceeded $20 million. We've doubled our inkjet capacity in 2012 to reach almost 2 billion pages. And we believe with Courier and Webcom, we're one of the two, three leading companies with the inkjet capacity in a single plant to service educational and other publishers. Four-color applications are the best applications for Book Forward programs, but single-color applications for trade and reference publishers are also housed in some of those Book Forward programs. How has it grown and how has it changed in our business? 2010, I think Webcom's mix of offset and digital was similar to the industry, which is around 4% of products were produced digitally. We were at about 2% in 2010, and you can see the increase in 2011, almost tenfold to 18% of total volume. High growth and development, as Barb mentioned in her research. How's it going for 2012? Where do we think it's headed? Well, with that 1.8 billion pages of capacity, we see that our digital business growing to over 30% of our total volume as we move through 2012. And if you're on the edge of your seat right now, Barb, here comes the news and how cost-effective these Book Forward programs can be for publishers. Just quickly go through two case studies that Webcom launched and announced at the March 2012 Publishing Business Conference. We released the results of a one-year study with two different publishers, one an educational publisher and one a trade publisher, who'd used the inkjet technologies and our book forward programs for a one-year period. If anyone's interested, they're available on our website in a bit more detail than I'll be able to go through today. But on the screen now, you can see an educational publisher, and on the left, profile of their work. On the left, you can see the number of projects that they worked with Webcom on in 2010. As a few hundred projects, and you can see that increased almost threefold, 240% increase of number of projects in 2011 versus 2010. A huge increase, and you'd also expect with a digital offer that the average size of those orders went down. And you can see on the right side of the screen, 2010, the average order size was over 200 copies, and in 2011 it was reduced by 27% to under 200 copies. Comparable story for a trade publisher of ours from the year 2010, just over 50 titles produced with Webcom, and they saw that almost double, 49% increase in 2011, and the average order there also went down 29% between the 2 years. So using a traditional book manufacturing paradigm, more orders and significant reduction of the average order size, I think we'd all expect the average cost of an order to go up when you produce less per order and you produce more orders. If you remember that educational publisher, they produced 27%. The average order was 27% less between those 2 years. And you can see that if their actual cost per order went down 49%, a 27% decrease in the volume per order, but they experienced a 49% reduction in their average cost per order, a significant impact of our book forward program and of the digital inkjet technology. You can see this trade publisher on the right-hand side, they had a 29% reduction in the average order size, and they had their costs reduced by 30%. And we just put on the right-hand side of the page the average cost per book, $1.53 in 1 year to $1.55. Basically, the conclusion here is they produced a lot less books at the same unit cost using the high-speed inkjet digital technology. So both these two book publishing book forward publishers experienced lower or comparable manufacturing costs, but in addition, they also benefited from cost savings that aren't outlined on the graph. They experienced improved use of their capital that wasn't tied up in inventories. They experienced lower obsolescence and risk of inventories that will never sell. They lowered their warehousing costs and space requirements, and probably most importantly, they had the ability to sleep well at night because they weren't worrying about large inventories sitting, waiting for orders that may or may not come for all the reasons that Neil outlined earlier in the presentation.
Mike, I got a quick question. Somebody's asking about the statistics here, and that 49% reduction,
yep.
Is that just relating to manufacturing costs, or are you taking into account all the other costs?
No, that's strictly a manufacturing cost number, so that 49% related to a 27% reduction in the average order size. I think most publishers and book manufacturers would think a 27% reduction in an order size would generally equate to maybe a 15 to 20% cost saving because of make-ready costs typically associated with offset printing. But not only did were we able to pass on those cost savings because the order sizes were lower, but we passed on another 20% plus production cost saving to that publisher based on them signing up for a volume commitment and using our book forward programs throughout the 1 year period.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, and then just concluding, I think similar conclusions to what's been outlined, that a successful book forward program requires a publisher and a manufacturer like Webcom to really look at the business opportunities and challenges that the publisher is experiencing today. It's a consultative process that we go through with our publishers and look at their product ordering and their inventory levels, their manufacturing unit costs, and what their business business goals and objectives are. We do the analysis and provide the recommendations and look at different options on how they can run their business to deal with all the challenges and the uncertainty in educational or other publishing markets. We quantify those benefits to them in a book forward program that help them reduce the returns, reduce their manufacturing costs, but basically improve their bottom line, grow their financial returns, and take control of their future and define their own success moving forward.
Great. Well,
so that does it.
Thanks, Mike. I'm gonna run about a minute over. I've got a couple quick questions that I want to make sure we get addressed. One of the first ones is for Neil. And Neil, the question said, is there a difference in funding for hardware in public versus private institutions? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, private institutions have more money. If you count parochial schools as private, that's not necessarily a true statement, but private schools, tend to be better funded in general and tend to be technology innovators in a lot of the areas I was talking about earlier.
Okay. Thanks, Neil. And then a quick question for Mike. Mike, for short runs to the U.S., how do you address customs issues?
32, as the slide said, 32% of all the products that Webcom supplies goes to U.S. publishers. And when we send a tractor trailer across the border, there's a $17 customs registration charge that we cover and build in. And many of the delivery services are certainly North American capable or worldwide competitive. So it's something that's 100% looked after. And just as U.S. publishers sending books into Canada, Canada is actually the largest market for U.S. publishers and all U.S. companies as an export market. So there's lots of trade back and forth between the two countries.
Okay. And one last question. I really don't have a clue on the answer to this, and this is going to go to Steve. But with the presses that you've got, can you print a book with a finished trim size of 11 by 15 saddle stitched?
No, because we come off the press with signatures. So that saddle stitching is not that capable.
Okay, got it. All right, well, guys, I want to thank everybody. And first of all, I'd like to thank our panelists as well as HP for sponsoring the webinar. And we do have some additional book business webinars coming up in September and October. And, you can visit HP.com, Gold Graphic Arts, for additional information about inkjet solutions. And I'd like to, again, thank everybody for their participation and, most importantly, our panelists. And so we, again, appreciate your time. And Steve and Neil and Mike, thanks so much for your participation. Have a great rest of the day, everybody, and hopefully you've seen new journeys that you can take with advances in technology.